You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
This is obviously a very, very high-class audience because usually at Brookings, we have raucous meetings around here, and it's usually very, very hard to get everybody to settle down. So obviously, our guests are going to set a new standard of courtesy and attention, and we really appreciate that. And I would like – I'm Strobe Talbot, by the way. I should introduce myself. It is my honor, and it has been for the last dozen years or so, to have as one of the great jobs in the world, and that is to work for Brookings Scholars. And there are a couple of them here this afternoon, and I will mention them. But it's also been my honor and pleasure over the years, going back to my days as a foreign correspondent, to spend quite a bit of time both in Turkey and on Turkey. And that part of my past has followed me here to Brookings. And one of the most important relationships that all of us at Brookings have with Turkey and with the private sector in Turkey is with TÜSİAD. And it's a great pleasure to welcome all of you, Muharrem Bey, and all of your colleagues. We have had a number of meetings both here in Washington and in Istanbul. In fact, I'm going to be enjoying your hospitality at the end of November. I think that everybody here, and it looks like there are quite a few who are in sort of standing room only positions in the back. There are some seats, by the way. If those of you who don't want to stand for the next hour and a half, please come up into the front here. So don't be bashful. We have an institutional partnership with TÜSİAD, and particularly for those in the room who are not connected with TÜSİAD, I just want to say a word about it. Because of TÜSİAD's role as one of the most significant civil society organizations in Turkey, and because of its interest and expertise in subjects that we try to follow here at Brookings, we have strengthened that partnership in recent years. And it has been particularly important to us in our Turkey program here at Brookings. And we're now lucky enough to have, thanks to the support of TÜSİAD, a TÜSİAD Senior Fellowship at Brookings. And Kamal Karisha, who's over here in the corner, is the incumbent in that position, and you will be hearing from him, of course, during the discussion today. We also have a series of publications known as the Turkey Project Policy Paper Series. I almost tripped up on that, but it's already something that we have good reason to be proud of. And in the most recent paper, you'll have a chance, if you haven't seen it already, to read our other Kamal Dervish, who has written an article on the implications of what we hope will be the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Pact for Turkey, for Turkey's relationship with the rest of the transatlantic community, and of course with the United States as well. Today's conversation could hardly be more timely and important, both because of the topic, which is events in the greater Middle East, and also because of the unique importance that Turkey is playing in that area and being affected, I might say. So both actively and passively, this is a subject of immense importance to Turkey and therefore of immense importance to the United States, given our longstanding NATO relationship with Turkey and the conviction of so many of us in this country. And I might add, even though we don't have a party line on anything at Brookings, we are very much into healthy and civil disagreement. I think that there are a couple of subjects where you wouldn't find very much disagreement at the Brookings Institution, and that is the importance of Turkey as a major European country that should have been long before now part of the European Union. Not that the European Union is at the top of its brand at the moment, but that's another issue that may or may not come up in discussions here today. Now, going back to the situation in the Middle East, and we have a number of our experts here on that. All of us in this town and on this side of the Atlantic are aware that while Turkey has tried to play a role throughout the area, 360 degrees, it is particularly preoccupied, as is the United States, with the situation in Syria. My friend Osman Boyner was mentioning to me as we were just coming in here the effect on the Turkish society and the Turkish economy of a great many refugees that have come over from Syria. And, of course, the dangers go far beyond that, as we all know, and you have experienced some of those dangers as well. We have a terrific group of scholars who are going to be speaking to you today. For those in the room who don't know the rich program that our Tusiad friends have had here in Washington, they spent some time this morning with the new Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, I guess is now the full title, Victoria Nuland. Victoria Nuland is a Foreign Service officer, which is to say a professional diplomat who has served both Republican and Democratic administrations, and who I feel I worked for back in the 1990s when I was in the State Department. She was my single most important, most influential, and most valued colleague in my own 8 years trying to contribute to the foreign policy of the United States. And Brookings is very much a family affair. Which is one reason that I'm very glad Mrs. Yılmaz could be with us today. And it's a family affair in another respect, which is having spent some time this morning with Victoria, you're going to spend some time with Mr. Nuland. No, I'm sorry. His name is Bob Kagan. Yes, right. Bob Kagan is a senior fellow here. I think all of you know of his work on the changing nature of the international system. He's also a historian. He is hard at work on the second volume of an extraordinary history of American foreign policy with the provocative title Dangerous Nation. He may or may not have reason to allude to that in the course of what you hear from him. Tamara Whittis is the director of our Saban Center on Middle East Studies here. Salih Uzal, you all know, of course. He has been a friend to many of us, and I might say in my own case, a mentor and teacher over the years, and I have already introduced Kamal Qureshi. So, Muharrem Bey, I would ask you to come up and formally get us going here, and I look forward to being present for as long as I can.
Dear guests, on behalf of TUSIAD, I would like to welcome you all to our joint conference with the Brookings Institution. The Brookings TUSIAD program on Turkey started in 2007. We have been able to see on many occasions the impact it had on Washington's perception of Turkey. I would like to thank all of those who have made this cooperation possible, fruitful, and promising. President Strop Talbot, Ambassador Mark Paris, Mrs. Fiona Hill, Mr. Ömer Taşpınar, our former Washington representative, Mr. Abdullah Akyüz, and our current representative, Mr. Barış Ornarlı. This year, we decided to take this partnership to a higher level by establishing the Turkey Forum that is directed by Professor Kemal Kirişçi, who also holds the TUSIAD chair at Brookings. We greatly value the relations between the United States and Turkey. In fact, all our efforts as TUSIAD since our decision to open a representative office in Washington focused on this goal. So far, some progress has been made to diversify Turkish-American relations and move them away from an explicit concentration on strategic issues. But there is more ground to be covered. Dear guests, as this panel will discuss, a new phase in world politics is opening. The United States is approaching the world with changed priorities and policies adjustment. Those shifts reflect more limited resources. As a new world order is arising, it is our view that the United States and Turkey should work ever more closely to attain their common strategic goals. Lately, there have been many disagreements between Ankara and Washington. These disagreements should not hide the commonality of interest that exists between us. For us, the right track is our Western alliance and the values we share with its members. A secular and democratic Turkey, in which the rule of law and fundamental rights and freedoms are secured, is indispensable for us. Dear guests, we are proud of the TÜSİAD Brookings joint program. I am confident that it will soon be the main source of understanding and analyzing Turkey's politics and its long-term direction. Already, the report of Professor Kirişçi on the transatlantic partnership process is a major contribution to an important debate. As I conclude, I am happy to announce an upcoming conference that TÜSİAD will hold in Istanbul in December. We look forward to reciprocating Brookings' hospitality when we host President Sutrup Talbot and his colleagues in Istanbul. Thank you for your attention and enjoy the panel. Thank you.
I'd like to extend to you all a good afternoon. Thank you for being with us today. I'd like to thank Strobe and also Muharrem Bey for their introductory remarks. And I need not say how exciting it has been so far for me holding this position and being part of the Brookings family, Strobe, as you said. I'm also delighted that we have received this TÜSİAD delegation in full force. Washington, D.C. needs such a presence. I'd like to proceed to our conference. Strobe has already introduced the speakers. Bob doesn't need a major introduction there, neither Tamara. But maybe some of you might not be very familiar with Soli. Soli is a very old friend of mine. We've come a long way in academia. And his ideas, his analysis of Turkish politics and foreign policy enriches not only my understanding of Turkish and regional politics, but also a lot of his readers and students. Soli is a professor at Kadir Has University, right by the Golden Horn, and works very closely with Tusiat as well. And he does have a column at a newspaper called Haber Türk. Although reading you might get you into some trouble in Turkey at times. So far, he's managed to survive himself. Today's topic is U.S. global leadership in the second Obama administration, priorities and realities. I think as we are closing, coming to the end of his first year in office, Barack Obama, clearly the United States has been facing a heavy agenda of foreign policy issues. And Middle East is certainly part of a very important part, if not domineering part of the agenda. That agenda, I say, has very positive aspects to it, which references have been made to negotiating the transatlantic trade and investment partnership with the EU, and on the other hand, the transpacific partnership with the Asia-Pacific countries. But beyond that, and maybe with the exception of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations that is being led by our vice president, the head of our foreign policy program, who is on leave right now, I sometimes wonder whether we have much positive news coming out from the Middle East. You're well aware what's happening in Syria, the humanitarian disaster there. Strobe has made references to the refugees. Actually, we just published with Elizabeth Ferris from the IDP program a report on the humanitarian crisis in Syria. And next week on Friday, we're flying to Turkey and to the border area to study the problem at a closer range. But you're also aware that after the chemical weapons were deployed or used in the outskirts of Damascus, the diplomacy and the politics surrounding the crisis in Syria has taken an unexpected turn. At one point, the expectation was that the objective was a regime change and even military intervention at a brief moment was on the cards. Today, the emphasis is much more on finding a diplomatic solution to the crisis. And this leaves the Turkish foreign policy in somewhat a difficult position, to use a diplomatic word there, and needing a substantive recalibration. Although we do see signs of it, at least in the horizon out there. Egypt, a topic that I know Bob follows very closely, has again taken an unexpected turn earlier in the summer. Today, you've, I'm sure, read the news that the United States, dare I say something undiplomatic, Bob, and say finally withdrawn the assistance, part of the assistance, especially military assistance to Egypt. That's a challenge out there. Depending on if you see the full or the empty side of the glass, the what's happened at the General Assembly of the United Nations with the arrival of the new president to newly elected president of Iran and the prospects of hopefully some diplomatic breakthrough in U.S.-Iranian relations may actually open a new page in terms of the Middle East and especially the polarization that has taken place there. So with those remarks, I'd like to turn the floor to Bob Kagan, who is going to make his remarks about 15 minutes, and then we will turn to his discussant. Bob, it's a personal pleasure and honor for me to be here with you.
Well, the feeling is mutual, Kamal. Thank you very much, and thank you to Tusiad, and it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk about America and the world, and less about U.S.-Turkish relations for a couple of reasons. One is that I'm not really an expert on U.S.-Turkish relations other than sharing everybody's love for Istanbul. But the other Strobe already mentioned, which is that if I say anything interesting about U.S.-Turkish relations, I'll wind up sleeping on the couch tonight, and and that's not my preference. So we will maybe get into some of it. And I do agree on how important U.S.-Turkish relations are. And I will say I did spend 6 years living in Europe telling Europeans that they really should bring Turkey into the European Union, which made me an extremely unpopular person in Belgium anyway. So, but I just want you to know I did my best. What I want to talk about today is relevant to Turkey and particularly relevant to the Middle East, and it is the very interesting, I think, paradox that a United States that remains extremely powerful and is, in fact, in roughly as strong a position internationally as it has often been throughout the past 60 years, nevertheless is acting like a weak and beleaguered power in the international system. Now, I think even when I say the first part, I probably get a number of puzzled looks. So let me just spend a moment talking about why I think that all this talk that we've had in recent years about the decline or relative decline in the United States is really turning out to be a bunch of baloney, to use a international relations term. You know, if you look at the measure that people most focused on, obviously when the United States was in the depths of the recession, which is when a lot of these theories were propounded, the United States was in relative decline. In fact, the American economy, although moving slowly out of recession, is doing fairly well. It has a reasonable rate of growth, lower than other periods, but certainly higher than other periods as well. But most importantly, when people are talking about the relative position of the United States, I think the general consensus among economists these days is that what you can certainly say about the United States is that it's doing pretty well in a pretty bad world situation, and particularly when you compare it to the famous BRICS, the countries that were doing so well by comparison in 2007, 2008, and which gave rise to this whole notion of America's relative decline. If you think back on the book that Fareed Zakaria was famous for, The Post-American World, it was a post-American world because the BRICS were rising relative to the United States. Well, now we see, as a number of economists, as some people at Morgan Stanley in particular have pointed out, that the BRICS are falling on harder times, their growth rates have slowed, and the general prediction is that their growth rates may fall to roughly the same growth rate as the United States, but of course the United States is a much larger economy, they have much smaller economies in some cases. The exception to some of these, the exception to this pattern, one of them is Turkey. I'm happy to say that Turkish growth continues to be stronger. China may or may not get out of its difficulties, but in any case, it's no longer possible to say that what we've got is the BRICS rising and the Americans relatively falling. That's just simply not the case. In terms of other measures of American influence, I think that again, if you look around the world and say, if not the United States, who? It's very hard to see who that is. I don't see China or India or Brazil stepping into a role of greater global involvement. No one seems to be, if the United States is losing influence and is devolving responsibility, as some claim, I don't see who's picking it up. In fact, as far as I'm able to tell, when things happen today, it still is a result at some point of American initiative. Certainly there is pressure on the American military budget, but of course, let's not forget, as people never tire of saying, the American military budget, even under the current cuts, is larger than the next 10 military budgets in the world combined. Americans, for better or for worse, American fighters have tremendous experience, which most other nations don't, And there are new technologies, again, and I say definitely for better or for worse, we won't maybe know yet, but the innovation of drones is going to revolutionize the deployment of power. And for the moment, the United States, and I say for the moment, has a near monopoly on that capability. It seems to me, reasonable measure, the United States should not be a country that should be regarded as in decline, weak, incapable. Even when you talk about limited resources, well, resources are always limited. They're never unlimited. I think America has the sufficient resources to perform the role that it has played often in the past, and especially since World War II. What's clear, however, is that Americans don't feel this way. They don't feel that they have that kind of capacity. They feel like they are in dire straits. And of course, when you're living through government shutdowns and this kind of nonsense, and not to mention just emerging from recession, it's easy to feel that way. And of course, there are other explanations for why Americans feel this way. The obvious one that people point to are the unpleasant experiences of the Iraq and Afghan wars, which seem to suggest, as Tammy has pointed out, the futility or the incapacity, even under circumstances of strength, to be able to succeed in those kinds of endeavors. That certainly is true. In general, Americans, by the way, periodically go through bouts of declinism. Almost every 10 years, there's a perception of decline. So that's sort of typical of Americans. And then I would add, and I think quite importantly, the role of the Obama administration. Now, let me hasten to say that even though I'm associated with Republicans, although mostly I don't particularly like Republicans, but I nevertheless am affiliated in some regards with Republicans, that despite that, I've actually tried to keep a pretty open mind about the Obama administration. I've written some positive things about them. I was optimistic about Obama at one time or another. You can check the record; it's out there somewhere. trust me. As I sit here right now, I really believe that this is we've had a very, very poorly run foreign policy for the past 6 years. And I think it's probably at the end of the day, and I've tried to think about what it's all about. I really think it's because this president just doesn't care very much about foreign policy. Now, where this has had the greatest and most obvious impact, turning to our general subject, is the Middle East. Because here you have a situation where you have a series of historic events, convulsions. I'm not here to say which way the Arab Spring ends up. I'm not an Arab winter kind of guy. I'd like to be optimistic. But what's undoubtedly the case is that we have had a moment here in that part of the world, just as we had a moment in Europe at one time, we had a moment in East Asia, and we've had a moment here. And the American response to this moment, especially if you compare it to the American response to a similar moment in Europe and a similar moment in Asia, has been really, there has been no real American response. And it's not an accident. President Obama came into office and made very clear to the American people that he wanted to pull out of all this involvement in the Middle East. There was a great increasing belief that it was nothing but trouble, that there was nothing to be gained from it. After all, aren't we becoming energy independent and what have you, and why do we even need to be in the Middle East anymore? And so at a time of great turmoil and crisis in the Middle East, crisis and opportunity, the United States has absented itself in a way that I think is almost unprecedented. Never mind that we have not provided the kind of economic assistance that we did provide to Europe after both World War II and after the fall of the Berlin Wall. But even sort of normal American kinds of influence have not been exerted. And Kamal mentioned Egypt, and Egypt is the most extraordinary case of underachievement by the United States that I have seen in quite some time. You know, people who think that America has no influence, they want to laugh when you say, well, your $1.5 billion aid to Egypt doesn't mean anything because the Saudis have $10 billion that they can give them tomorrow, and they can, and the other Gulf states have billions that they can give them. That's always been true. The Saudis have been rich for a long time, is my understanding. I'm not a Middle East expert, but I think the Saudis have been rich for a long time. They've always had the money out there. But in my impression, the Egyptian military values the strategic relationship with the United States very highly. And if this administration had had the courage to put that relationship at risk in a serious fashion, I believe that we might not have had what we've had now. And let me also say, if the United States had used the influence it had when Morsi was president to try to influence Morsi's behavior, and if the United States had used the influence it had when Mubarak was president to influence Mubarak's behavior, to have him conduct a kind of opening that might have prevented some of the worst aspects of this revolution from occurring, we would be in better shape right now. But this administration is so convinced of two things. One, that America really doesn't have the capacity to have that kind of influence, and I won't even get into Syria where I think they've shown that again and again, but also that the American people don't want to have this kind of role and wouldn't support it. And in fact, it seems to me what the administration has created is what I guess they call a feedback loop. The American people send signals that they don't want to be engaged. The administration reinforces those signals and sends them back saying, right, we don't want to be engaged and we couldn't do anything, which then reinforces even more strongly American public opinion. And right now, as Americans, I hate to say this, it's unfortunate. Right now, Americans look at the Middle East and their basic attitude is they should all just kill each other. And we don't want to be involved and we don't want to get into it. And there's a very rising tide of Islamophobia in the United States that affects Americans' thinking about everything that happens in the Middle East, but none of which leads them to say we need to be involved. And again, this is reinforced by the administration. And so the net result is that a region that it seems to me, if history is any kind of guide, requires some kind of outside involvement, lest it sort of, you know, erupt into complete turmoil, is now lacking that kind of outside involvement. Now, I'm not here to say, and I will preempt my colleagues to say, I'm not here to say that when America does get involved, it always does so brilliantly. It does not. And that's true of every part of the world that America's gotten involved with. America is a far from perfect executor of deployer of its own power. But nevertheless, I believe that in Syria, in Egypt, there has been a necessity for a stronger American role. And for all kinds of reasons, the United States has not been playing it. And it seems to me, if history is any guide, the only moment at which the United States will finally involve itself in a meaningful way will be when it's become so awful, so disastrous, that the price of American involvement is going to be much, much, much higher. Right. By the way, that's in keeping with the American character. We stayed out of Europe for 20 years and then had to go fight World War II. It wouldn't be the first time, but I wish that we would understand the stakes and understand the importance of getting America back into the game. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I personally would have loved to continue to listen to your line. It's like music as one listens to you. I don't know if it's Chopin or Mozart, but I also suspect that many have this big question in their mind. What should the U.S. had been doing this far? But I'll let that question hang up there,
good.
Because I know Tamara is jumping up and down. You've made references to a period when Tamara served as deputy assistant for Near East Affairs in the Department of State. So I suspect she will have a few things to say and respond to Bob there.
Sure. Well, I don't want to. First of all, let me say thank you. Thank you to Tusiad, and it's really a treat for me to be here. And to emphasize, too, that I'm not sure we're going to be perhaps point-counterpoint, because I think that a number of the points that Bob just made, I would not quarrel with. But I do want to try and delve a little bit into the interaction between the domestic politics and policy environment here in the United States that the Obama administration is dealing with, and the realities on the ground in the Middle East today, the interaction between those two things, and how it is that we are where we are. Now, I think we can all be forgiven if we arrive here in mid-October in Washington with a real sense of whiplash about America's policy toward the Middle East. If you were to have taken a snapshot even 6 or 8 months ago, you would have been talking about a pivot away from the region, withdrawal, a desire to disengage, as Bob was describing. If you had taken a snapshot in late August or early September, only 6 or 8 weeks ago, it seemed as though the United States was perhaps on the precipice of a new military engagement in the Middle East. And here we are in mid-October looking at a president who has committed himself to not one, not two, but three high-stakes diplomatic gambits in the region with Iran, with serious chemical weapons, and an effort to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it's been an amazing seesaw. So how are we to understand this? I would agree with Bob that this was a president who spent his first 4 years in an effort to roll back, in many ways, an approach to the Middle East that I think he said several times he feels that he was elected, at least in part, to dismantle, an approach that was perceived by many here and by many in the region as overly military, too heavy of a military footprint, too much unilateral leadership and determination of approaches by the United States, and as former National Security Advisor Tom Donilon put it in a speech to the Asia Society this spring, a region in which the United States was relatively overinvested as compared to other parts of the world like Asia. And yet, events in the region seemed to, in a sense, drag the administration back in almost against its will. Now, it's certainly the case that events on the ground in the region have prevented a situation in which the United States could say this region is relatively stable, there's a defined order that seems like it will be sustainable, we can therefore turn relative attention and resources elsewhere. The region is undergoing a tectonic shift. And this presents a problem for the United States and for every actor in and around this region, because for half a century, the United States has essentially been a defender of the regional status quo in terms of the balance of power and the dominant actors. And there is now no status quo to defend. So there's a basic strategic reorientation that will have to take place, but at a moment when the trajectory of the Middle East itself is so unclear, it's hard for the United States to figure out what that reorientation should look like. Yes, the American public is tired, it's impatient, it's inward looking. Yes, our resources are constrained. All of those things play a role. But I think that there's a third factor as well that has complicated America's approach to the region over the last couple of years and in many ways will prevent the United States from disengaging in some of the ways that that might have been expected. And that third factor is about America's relationships with key actors in the region, precisely because the region has been so thoroughly upended, the regional order has been so thoroughly upended precisely because there's no status quo left to defend. It used to be that the United States and its major regional partners were very much on the same page supporting that same status quo agenda. At this time, I think, there are some pretty fundamental differences between the United States and key regional actors in assessing what caused this earthquake. What are the roots of instability in the region today? What are the primary threats to us, to our partners in the region today? And what is necessary to return the regional order to some sort of stability? I think there are disagreements between the United States and Arab states on those questions. I think we've seen those emerge in Bahrain, in Egypt. I think there are differences between the United States and Israel on some of these questions. I think there are some differences between the United States and Turkey on some of these questions. And I hope that we'll have a chance to discuss all of that. But until those disagreements are resolved, not only will you see continued demands from the region for greater American engagement, but what you see is, I think, quite a lot of lobbying, of advocacy toward the White House about what view it should take of the region, what approach it should take. And those advocates are not are rarely unified. It's notable to me, in the face of these pressures, in the face of the turmoil in the region, and the threats that it's produced, where President Obama has chosen now to place his bets. And let's take a look at the speech that he gave at the UN a few weeks ago. He set aside, he didn't repudiate, but I would say he very clearly set aside the rhetoric that he enunciated in May 2011, the approach to the region that that speech laid out, which was one rooted in the premise that the Arab revolutions were driven by bottom-up demands for more transparent, accountable, responsive government, in other words, for democracy and human rights, that the region had become unstable because leaders were not responding to those demands, and that stability would not return until there was more democratic government. That rhetoric was pretty much absent from the UN speech. And I think what we saw instead was a focus on nearer-term goals, the protection of narrow security interests when it comes to Egypt, and advancing diplomatic solutions to these major challenges with Syria, Iran, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. But it's interesting what the president achieved in making this shift. He took a moment of intense demand for a larger American role, demand and ambivalence, let's be very clear, but demand nonetheless. And he seemed to be saying three things, I would say, sub rosa in that speech. First, to the American public, I hear you. I'm not opposing you. I understand your mood. But that doesn't mean we can do nothing. If we do nothing, there are bad consequences, and we can't afford that. Number two, I think, was a message addressed to the world at large, saying, I haven't changed. I still have a preference for non-military tools and for non-unilateral approaches. And the third message, therefore, to key international partners and members of the international community like Russia and China, was setting expectations, saying, if you want me to maintain these preferences, and if you want me to restrain the aspects of American engagement that you say you found so troubling with the last guy, then you have to step up. This is not going to be a unilateral process. This diplomacy demands that we all pitch in. I think those were the three core messages for the that the president sent in Geneva. Now, I mean, in New York. The big question hanging out there, of course, is, will he pull it off? I said these are three high-stakes diplomatic gambits. They are. They are all high-wire acts without a net. What happens if one or more of these diplomatic efforts fails to resolve the question to which it is addressed? Well, with Iran, we know the answer. It's hanging out there, and it is repeatedly articulated, and it's a military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. On Syria, the demands for American military engagement that were staved off by this U.S.-Russian compact over chemical weapons will immediately return fiercer for the intervening period of time. And on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, I don't think there's an answer that involves American military engagement, and I don't think there's a demand for that. But I think we can expect that given the dynamics on the ground between the parties, even with the very careful lowering of expectations by the United States and everybody else for these talks, if these talks break down, if there is no political horizon for Israelis and Palestinians, we know what the trajectory looks like, and it is really, really destabilizing. So just to end with this point, I think the White House would argue that they have been very disciplined and very restrained in maintaining their intentions and their basic foreign policy approach in the face of tremendous pressure. And this allows them to focus their attention in places where they think they can make a real difference. But these are high-risk endeavors. And should they fail, I think the administration is going to find itself without a lot of support here at home and without a very strong foundation abroad for taking steps that it might then need to take to address the crises that will result. And I'll stop there.
Well, thanks, Tamara. That was a very nuanced approach there. Many questions, many thoughts that we ought to bear in mind. As I listened to Bob as well as Tamara, of course, I couldn't help but look at these things from the perspective of Turkey. Especially when Bob was talking about the American tradition of involvement and how it fluctuates. The Turkish tradition was not to get involved in the Middle East in any manner, maybe other than an economic one. Whereas with the Arab Spring or the tectonic shifts that Tamara made references to, Turkey or the Turkish government did take one mighty nosedive into it. And on Syria took a very categorical position. On Egypt took a very categorical position. On Iran, it was always much more nuanced. I think it's a product of a tradition of long bilateral relations going back centuries. But these categorical positions that Turkey has taken, when juxtapositioned with the positions that the U.S. has taken, it looks like it has left Turkey a little bit out in the cold. And there are even references in the media saying the lone man out there. And I think it's that point, at that point that I should bring in Soli. Soli has been writing extensively on this, and I look forward to hearing his views. Where do we go from here in the case of Turkey, and how is Turkey going to respond to these 3 points, especially that Tamara has raised? 3 high wire acts.
How should I know?
I know you're going to say Turkey is in one high wire act. That it
that's also true.
We should have a big net.
I'll try to speak to how I see Turkish foreign policy shaping, or that how it needs to be shaped, in my view, and how Turkish-American relations, what kind of course Turkish-American relations need to take. But before that, I mean, it's not always that I find the opportunity to say something about Robert Kagan in his presence. So, I'm just going to quote someone who I'm sure you know and from maybe respect, and that's Zbigniew Brzezinski's latest book, Strategic Vision, has a couple of sentences, passages that I personally like a lot. Brzezinski says in the book at one point that no success at home can be truly comprehensive if resources are wasted on debilitating foreign misadventures. And he's been a close advisor to the president, to the best of my knowledge. Then, in what I consider to be a very poetic thing, and I think it speaks to the hubris of the Bush administration and those who intellectually supported that administration's policies, he writes, states, like individuals, are driven by inherited propensities, their traditional geopolitical inclinations and their sense of history. And they differ in their ability to discriminate between patient ambition and imprudent self-delusion. This was, of course, comparing China and the United States. But, of course, I always took the imprudent self-delusion to refer to Turkey. But in this case as well, you never know how patient you should be about your ambition and how much you can allow yourself to be self-deluded. And that is, in my view, something that both the United States and Turkey need to confront. Now, when we look at American foreign policy, again, as you said, 6 months ago, we wish the world disappeared. Then 6 weeks ago, okay, red lines have been crossed, you know, we're going to deploy the full force of the United States, and then, but let me ask Congress. You know, the moment anybody hears in the world the word Congress, I guess like you, it's like, oh my God, okay. And then, of course, this speech, which I personally found to be a seminal speech. I mean, it may falter everything that's said there, the premises, as you've explained, but it also set a new framework, and that I personally find very exciting. Well, otherwise, I guess the rest of the world and most of the people in Turkey look at Obama's policy abroad, and there are really no surprises in our reaction. Code words, Turks like everybody else, well, prestige, credibility, decisiveness, or lack thereof, okay? So for a lot of people in Turkey, the Obama administration with its willy-nilly actions, with its indecisiveness, has really lost a lot of credibility. It has lost a lot of prestige. And my God, the world has no point of reference anymore. I personally, again, this is probably a minority view, I personally don't share that. And I'll look at it in a very simplistic way. However he may have come to that stop, the president did not want to get into a military engagement in Syria, and he's not militarily engaged there. He favored from day one an opening with Iran, and now has one. Again, if these things fail, what he needs to do may be much more cumbersome for the United States, and he may not find the political capital to pursue that. But from the beginning, this is what he wanted to do or didn't want to do, and this is where he finds himself. I also find that part of the criticism addressed to this administration is a bit unfair. It infuriates us at times as well. You know, why couldn't you have done this? Why couldn't you have done that? Why did you give the Cairo speech if you were not going to follow through and all that? However, my sense of what the Obama administration or the president himself tried to do when he came to power was to basically change the rhetoric, change the style of engaging with the rest of the world, and basically offered a hand to almost everyone, to the Chinese, to the Russians, to the Middle Easterners, whatever. And I remember thinking at the time that, well, he has made his offers. It looks genuine. What if people don't grab his hand? And I think this is precisely what happened. Nobody responded. Everybody wanted to be a free rider. I mean, the Chinese buy more oil from the Middle East than you do. Do they do anything constructive? No. And then I understand the calculation. Why should we be bearing the burden if that burden is going to be depleting our resources that really need to be replenished? Maybe we need more time to replenish them before we actually get engaged so actively in almost every problem. So I kind of understand the logic, although I'm fearful of failures and consequences. So in my view, the president actually is doing what he had in mind when he came to power. He's bringing America's ambitions in harmony with its newly reduced capacities, because the fact that you are in absolute terms, the best endowed country politically, economically, and militarily, there are other forces that we did not really have to take into account in previous times that are actually capable of basically making your ambitions collapse, which is what happened in Iraq, kind of what happened in Vietnam. That is, you're not just dealing with states, you deal with non-state actors, and you deal with intangible things such as nationalism, and you really cannot run the world as in the 19th century at gunpoint. So he's relativizing American power. For me, that is welcome. For others, it may not be. Now, whether or not all of these trends are going to outlive his term remains to be seen. The result may be a consequence of his success or failure in these two issues he identified as his priorities in the UN speech. Again, like Tamara, I take that speech to be a very important speech and maybe full of traps too. And that's, of course, Iran and the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Now, obviously, the fact that I have a more positive view of where the administration stands on foreign policy does not mean I think it's faultless. Needless to say, the Middle East is in a state of unraveling. We can debate endlessly the role of the United States because of its wars and because of its, I think, long-drawn-out support of the status quo has played in this, but there's no point in getting into that. Turkey obviously has been affected by what had happened, what is happening. Since the Gulf War of 1990-91, arguably, and certainly since the Iraq War, the environment has changed mostly favorably for Turkey, but lately in a risk-producing way. Despite appearances, my view of Turkish-American relations during the turbulence of the past decade and a half is that relations were set on a strong foundation. In the decade to the eruption of Arab revolts in particular, and in spite of occasional moments of friction and tension, the fundamental commonality of interest held. I look at three speeches. President Clinton comes to Turkey in 1999, gives this speech. We all loved it. 5 years later, President Bush comes to Turkey. He's supposed to be the non-Clinton. He gives exactly the same speech. 5 years later, President Obama comes to Turkey. He's supposed to be the non-Bush. He gives another variation, you know. He's more poetic. It's no longer strategic partnership, but it's model partnership. Okay, so at the end of the day, despite all the frictions, these things fundamentally held, all right? Turkey benefited immensely, in my view, from its alliance with the United States during that period. And surprisingly, it benefited both from the failures and the successes of the United States in Iraq. The two countries succeeded in managing their relations well, and mostly, not always, in harmony. Since the outbreak of the Arab revolts, things have moved in the wrong direction. I would attribute this as much to Turkish hubris, always a distorter of proper analysis, as the Americans know from the Iraq War, as to the indecisiveness of American foreign policy. In Turkey, I think we're in dire need of a reassessment of our foreign policy. We have to really sit down seriously without getting into a blame game and reconsider how profoundly the environment has changed in which we are trying to conduct our foreign policy. And I think we should be downgrading the ideological driving force that has been, I think, sitting in the driver's seat for our conduct of our foreign policy in the year and a half. Now, I see in this country a mood of dismissiveness about Turkey. I personally think that is wrong-headed. A country can actually make mistakes in its policies that doesn't exchange the fundamentals of its being, of its presence, and of its importance, in my view. Turkey would have to adjust itself to the fact that being right politically on any given matter, and I think it was right to oppose the coup, whether or not one liked the Brotherhood, I think it was right to want to get rid of Bashar al-Assad, by the way, President Obama said it even before our prime minister did. Being right is not enough. To show to the world that you are right necessitates the use of the right language, proper words, and management skills in diplomatic relations. A good starting point in the bilateral relations, in my view, would be to acknowledge once again that the goals for the two countries remain common. Both countries want to get rid of Al-Assad clan. We may not agree on who should replace him. Both countries wish to avoid an Iran that has nuclear weapons. Obviously, on methods, we have differed more than occasionally. And obviously, bring to closure the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And that brings me to my final point. When we deal with the foreign policy of any given country, most of the time, not always, domestic politics do not really get in the way, okay? Even in Turkey, where 80% of the population seems to be against the conduct of policy vis-a-vis Syria, the government still continues in its wrong-headed way. But nobody thinks of the Turkish parliament or Turkish public opinion to drastically reverse or to be an obstacle to the conduct of Turkish foreign policy. In the United States, the equilibrium in your domestic politics, the power of certain lobbies or segments of the foreign policy making apparatuses, institutions, and whatever, is so overwhelming that even when the country tries what the rest of the world might consider the right path in, let's say, in the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and of course, a Brookings hand has that thankless job of doing what nobody else could have done before, it is very difficult to count on the United States, on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. It is very difficult to trust that the United States can actually go in one direction without being restricted because of its domestic politics. And the same fear, personally, I have, and I think I share this with many other people around the world, not just in Turkey, the same thing may play out in Iran as well. So the cautionary remarks that you made, Tamara, I think hold, not because the United States does not have the capability of conducting these policies correctly, but domestic politics may get in the way. I'll stop here.
Whew. I warned you about Soli, but I must also confess that I do agree with a lot of the lines he has shared with us. Maybe one point I'd like to add from Turkey's point, from the Turkey perspective, is that, Soli, I don't know if you'll agree with me, there is the beginnings of an effort to adjust to the changes that have occurred in the Middle East, or an effort to adjust Turkish foreign policy, especially on Syria, maybe to a lesser invisible manner on Egypt as well. And I'm also tempted to argue that that adjustment is not only a response to maybe the U.S. or the international environment, but also a response to that so-called bottom-up process. Maybe public opinion doesn't still play the role that it plays here in the U.S., but there are also other domestic interest groups that have expressed one way or the other their discomfort with the foreign policy that unfolded until very recently. We still have 20 minutes for debate and discussion. I thought, Tamara and Bob, the way we could do is take questions and then maybe also put your responses to each other together for the benefit of those who are with us. Yes, the floor is yours. Steve, you're right in the front, but let me first take a question from the back and I'll come to you, all right? You are strategically Ukraine. Yes, I'm leading from behind.
Hello, my question
please
is directed...
Please, your name and also some background, institutional.
Oh,
we have a tradition at Brookings that the person who takes the floor shares their name with us and their institutional affiliation.
Mm-hmm. My name is Julio Alejandro. I am a Mexican citizen, and I was just interested to come here to understand more about international politics and the Middle East. I do not come from a specific institution. So my question is, what is the influence that public opinion have in the Middle East in terms to try to change the discourse of public opinion inside the public and inside the media of Turkey? So how does other Islamic or Arab states, the way that they feel and the way that they create a sense of public policy regarding to public opinion, what is the impact that has into Turkish politics? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Steve, Let's take three questions. And Steve.
Yeah, the microphone's coming.
It's arriving.
Steve Larrabee, the RAND Corporation. Bob, I agree with a lot of what you said, and I think that the declinism is overdrawn. But I also think that you've drawn a little bit of a caricature of the Obama administration. And I think Tamara has added some useful...
Steve, bring the mic a bit closer to you. They can't hear anything.
Useful additions. After all, I mean, when you think this, the Obama administration inherited a certain situation. It wasn't. It didn't create the problems in the Middle East. And in fact, those problems, in some ways, in many ways, were created by the Bush administration views on democracy. And then they were very surprised to find that when they promoted democracy, for what I think was good reasons, then Islamists and others that we didn't like used the electoral system to their advantage. And the point is that by the time the administration came into office, the Obama administration, there was an awful lot of broken crockery, and a lot of things were under assault, and they inherited that. And I think in many ways they did a fairly good job. Where I would agree with you, where they fell down really, is in Syria, where I think they really should have been much more active much sooner, and it would have what they did was leave the political vacuum for the jihadists to take advantage. But on Egypt, you know, most of your Republican colleagues would say we shouldn't have done anything. We should have supported Mubarak and the military. And you say, well, we should really withdraw most aid, if I understand you from your writings. But I think the military in Egypt had decided to do what they were going to do regardless, and they would have continued on their path pretty much as they did. So I'll stop there, but it just seems to me that if you look at what the Obama administration has tried to do, it has a better record than you give it credit for. But the thrust of the criticism I agree with.
Thanks, Steve. One more question maybe. Yes, in the middle there.
Hi, my name is Audrey Williams. I'm from the Stimson Center, and I really enjoyed the talk here today. I find it extremely interesting. And I had a question about specifically about the U.S.-Turkey relationship. I didn't hear as much talked about with the recent way that during the discussion or the negotiations between Russia and the U.S., Turkey was left out a little bit, and there was a lot of perception, especially on Erdogan's part, that Turkey didn't have as much of a role initially in this whole diplomatic solution in Syria. And I wondered if the panelists could talk a little bit to that dynamic, that recent dynamic in the Turkish-U.S. relationship, if it has any implications, if that has any implications in terms of how Turkey is going to start changing its foreign policy, or how that kind of affected Turkey's whole approach to Syria and to U.S. relations in general. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Well, I see a question for each speaker here. Bob, maybe we should start with you, your response to Steve, and then Tamara and Soli.
Well, I agree, Steve, that obviously the administration inherited a lot of difficulty in the Middle East, that including effects on America's image and including America's public opinion about involvement, et cetera. I mean, although I would also say every administration inherits the garbage that the last administration left for them. The Bush administration inherited a situation which ultimately led to the 9/11 attack. Well, that's your opinion. I mean, you know, I think you could. There's a lot of records that most presidents leave for each other. But more specifically on the question of Egypt, I mean, if you wanted to tell me that they left a mess in Iraq that he had to deal with, and he left a mess on the peace process that he had to deal with, I would have been more sympathetic. But Egypt, I don't agree with. For one thing, Bush didn't set off the Arab Spring. I mean, that happened in Tunisia. Unless you want to give him credit for Iraq somehow setting off the Arab Spring, which I know a lot of Bush supporters want to do, but I'm more skeptical. But on Egypt, By the way, my Republican colleagues are dead wrong about Egypt, and I think that this administration has actually followed Republican policy toward Egypt, and also, by the way, Israeli policy toward Egypt, pretty consistently, except for the period of the Morsi rule. But, you know, I'm sure Tamara would say this from having been inside the administration. I could say it from having followed this issue really closely. There was a moment in the Mubarak period when I believe if the administration had managed to convince Mubarak using the necessary pressures I think would have been required, even to hold a reasonably fair and open parliamentary election, that Mubarak might have actually survived the turmoil that came. The fact that he, in fact, tightened up in Egypt and then started talking about how Gamal was going to be the next leader, and then he got sick, I think a lot of Egyptians just said, no, this cannot happen. And that was the moment when an administration, which has a lot of influence with a guy like Mubarak, just the way Reagan did with Marcos, the way Gaston Seeger did with the South Koreans, and said, you know what, Mr. President, now is the time for you to make this move. They didn't want to go near it. Okay, so they did nothing until it was already too late. And the notion, by the way, that we could have supported Mubarak at that point, he was already gone. He lost that country. We didn't push him out. Then I quickly, just to say, when the SCAV was in power, we did nothing to make sure that they did what they needed to do. When they were in a very tenuous position, when Morsi was elected, we didn't use the influence we might have had. We got very close to Morsi. The administration's policy in Egypt has been, who's ever in power, that's our buddy. And they've never wanted to use their influence to put any pressure. And now, finally, with the Egyptian military, I know that the administration thinks that the military was going to take over no matter what they did, but the military counted on the fact that the administration would do exactly what it did, which was nothing, when they did the coup. The military read the administration perfectly. I don't know, and you don't know, what would have happened if Obama had called Sisi and said, I am going to cut you off the minute you do this, and had really meant it. I think that they might have, and by the way, this was the worst possible outcome. The best outcome was the Muslim Brotherhood loses the next election. That was the best outcome, and that's the outcome that was in America's interest, I believe would be in the Egyptian people's interest, and that was not what the administration was capable of doing. You can't blame all that on George Bush. I love to blame everything on George Bush. But, I mean, you know, George Bush can be blamed for everything that's bad that's happened in the world, but not Egypt.
Bob, the examples about Mubarak and Gamal, and then also about Sisi, were great examples. What could have they done with Morsi?
Morsi was in a weak position in Egypt because he didn't control the military. That would be the weakest aspect of his position. I think he was a very unfortunately, you know, he wasn't the right man for this job, and he thought that because he had a majority, he could do whatever he wanted. I think that we had the capacity to put public pressure on him, mm-hmm. private pressure on him, as well as aid pressure on him. Can I guarantee that he would have therefore done the right thing? No. What I know is that we didn't do any of that.
Tamara, I know.
Yeah, please defend the administration.
Tamara. No, I'm not. As you know, as Bob knows well, this is not an arena where I'm going to defend the administration. But let me add one dimension, because we've been talking here about pressure and about sticks. And I think that, Bob, as I understood your initial remarks, part of what you were saying was that it's a failure by the administration to invest in certain ways that then creates a greater cost to be borne down
correct,
the line.
Right.
You know, I had a professor in college who, you know, wanted us to work on our public speaking and take risks in the classroom. And he would always say to us, bleed a little now so you don't hemorrhage later, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this was more or less the thrust of your remarks. And I would argue that not only was pressure not exerted in certain ways, but that the previous administration and the current administration at critical moments failed to make investments that could have pulled, that could have been a magnet to pull Egypt in the right direction. President Obama, in May 2011, promised the Egyptian government $1 billion in debt relief. The president, and it's not all Obama's fault. Part of it gets back to the domestic politics that we've been talking about. The president also proposed a Middle East incentive fund in January 2012 of $770 million. Now, that's not a lot of money for the whole region. But neither of those initiatives went anywhere, both because the administration did not push them hard enough and because Congress was in no mood to appropriate new money. You're talking about the difference between the U.S. response to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the U.S. response to historic transformations in the Middle East. We had opportunities even to leverage relatively modest resources together with others to make a positive difference in this region, and we fell down on that. I understand that as of now, the United States alone has spent $1 billion on humanitarian relief in Syria, and we couldn't muster anything close to $1 billion in our response to four historic Arab revolutions. So I think we just have to recognize not only the failures to coerce, but the failures to use carrots in creative and effective ways as well.
Mm-hmm. Tamara, would you mind also maybe reflecting on the question that came from our Mexican friend there about public opinion, and especially in the context of the way public expressed itself in Egypt and in a way inadvertently maybe paved the way to a coup rather than to what Bob would have preferred, an election less than a year down the line in Egypt.
Sure. Well, look, I think you have several effects simultaneously. You have mobilization of the public in Egypt, in Tunisia, and elsewhere on a mass scale that had not happened for a long time in the Arab world. And with the revolutions, people had a sense that what had seemed impossible was possible. And I think that, you know, having pushed out Mubarak in February 2011, having, in the view of many Egyptian protesters, forced the SCAF to yield power to Morsi in June 2012, the Egyptian public was very ready to believe that if they weren't happy with President Morsi, they could go in the streets and force another change. Mm. And indeed, many of them, when you say today, you know, but look what you've done. You've thrown yourselves into the lap mm-hmm. of the military and the internal security services. They say, don't worry, we can do it again. Mm-hmm. They have great confidence that as mobilized as they are and as effective as they've demonstrated in bringing down governments, they'll do it again. Given the trajectory in Egypt today and the reemergence of the security state, one can only hope they're right. So I think that's one dimension, and that certainly has a demonstration effect, and I would love to hear from you or from Sully how that might have affected the public protests that we've seen in Turkey this year. But we certainly saw the effect elsewhere in the region, including in Israel, which saw a massive social movement emerge in the summer of 2011 in a very unexpected way and change Israeli politics. So there's no doubt that public opinion, public mobilization, public sentiment is having an impact. But I wouldn't argue that there's a unidirectional impact. I think it's quite complicated. Egypt today is a very divided place. And I think, too, that the lessons others take away observing those manifestations can differ. In Jordan, I think they've looked at what's happened in Egypt and they say, okay, we don't want that. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, there are continued demonstrations in Jordan against raising of fuel prices and things like that, but it's of a completely different order.
And Syria is even a worse a reference point. Soli, there was a question on Turkey and the U.S., but I think you can reflect on the others as well.
Well, when are we ending?
We still have 5 minutes
okay.
or so.
Yeah. Well, Turkey was left out. I mean, it's not that it felt left out. I think it was left out. Ultimately, the United States and Russia have managed to come to some kind of understanding. Whether they'll carry through remains to be seen. Remember, that at that point, when the president was still in the mood of attacking without asking Congress, Turkey actually presented itself as a voluntary ally to whatever kind of coalition would be pulled together. And at the end of the day, no coalition was put together, and the president took the diplomatic route. And since Turkey wants immediate relief from Bashar's presence in Damascus, obviously it also felt disappointed. And then, as the president of Turkey has encountered while he was in New York about 10 days ago, there is this incredible pressure on Turkey about allegations concerning Turkey's help to particular groups or his tolerance for jihadist groups in Syria, which also alienated Turkey from the rest of the allies who also would like to see the back of Bashar al-Assad and his regime. So in that sense, this is the kinds of positions that Turkey will have to really come back from, and that is why I think we need to have a different type of dialogue. There are clashes of interest between Turkey. Turkish and American interests are not identical. One should not expect those interests to be identical. We have a 900-600 mile border with Syria. You don't. You can be very careless. I mean, you may not care about it. We have to. I think we mismanaged the Syria policy. But I see no reason as to why Turkey and the United States cannot have a different type of dialogue, having learned from the mistakes of the past.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Soli. We still have a few minutes. I think I can take two very quick questions and then turn to the panel. Right at the back, and then maybe one from the right-hand side there.
My name is Stephen Shore. Mr. Kagan had made the analogy about our alleged wonderful success with the fall of the Berlin Wall and against our alleged failure with the Arab Spring. But isn't that analogy fundamentally misleading? The Reagan administration was actively involved in destabilizing the satellite countries, although the speed with which took the first Bush administration by surprise. In the Arab, we had no anticipation of the speed of the Arab Spring, no known cooperation with potential partners, and policy obviously was being made on a daily basis rather than in accord with any strategy, unlike the case with Eastern Europe. And even Eastern Europe has Hungary, which was not exactly today a democratic model.
Hey, Kathy, at the far end, a brief question behind you. No, there. Right. Far end. I'm sorry. I promised him. Yeah, he's been very patient.
Thanks to the panelists. Appreciate it. There's a scene from Godfather 3 that comes to mind in this regard of U.S. foreign policy. Mike says, just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
It's the only scene from Godfather Part 3.
That anybody even remembers.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
And interesting,
yeah, that's
that you
the
should,
worst one.
Interesting that you should comment on it, Dr. Kagan, because this question is for you. To the extent that the president has had advisors, political scientists, historians, Bob Dalek comes to mind, Dr. Goodwin, Doug Brinkley, to the Oval, to counsel him essentially on foreign policy. Have you been in the wing chairs between Lincoln and King to talk about U.S. foreign policy? And if you haven't, how would you counsel him? Thanks.
Bob,
I have, but he hasn't listened to me.
There was another question there about the
Eastern Europe, Eastern Europe and Arab Spring.
I don't want to make any grand claims for it. I just do think that when the Berlin Wall fell, it was regarded in the United States and in American foreign policy circles and in the two administrations that were at least tangentially involved in it, as a significant moment that required, massive attention by the U.S. government.
And Congress passed within 6 weeks.
Major aid, and the fact, I mean, I can go down the list of things that you said. The fact that we were sort of involved in destabilizing, although I think the Polish Solidarity Movement would want to take most credit for what happened, and the people of Germany who tried to get through Berlin probably deserve most of the credit. But we also destabilized the Middle East, too. So I would say that that's true. And the fact that Hungary is not a good democracy now, which is very it doesn't discredit, you know, I didn't realize perfection was our goal in foreign policy. I would take even gross imperfection, actually. But I don't think there's any question that there's a major distinction in the way we approach these two problems. And again, Tamara knows better than I do, having been in the administration, but, you know, for those of us who met with the administration officials again and again and again, at every meeting they said, we know, we've really got to get a grip on this thing, and we've really got to completely rethink, et cetera, et cetera, and it just never happened. And you, yeah, the world's a busy place, and life is complicated, but if you want to, I think it is just very easy to draw a distinction between the way the U.S. government organized itself to deal with post-Berlin Wall Europe and how they did not organize themselves and devote the kind of attention to the Middle East. And again, what is surprising? The president wanted to get out of the Middle East, not get deeper in. He would have had to turn on a dime, and that's not an easy thing to do.
Tamara and Soli, maybe one final words.
You know, I think there's one other point that's worth raising as we think about the U.S. role in the region and dealing with the Arab revolutions, which is that, and Bob got at this a little bit in his response to Steve earlier, these events were driven from within the region. These were the result of social and demographic and economic trends in the Arab world that had been building for at least a decade, if not more. And, you know, if you think I'm just saying this now in a self-serving way, you can go and look at the things I was writing in 2007 and 2008. I wrote an entire book arguing that the political economy, the model of the Arab Republic, was breaking down. So I really think it's important that we not overstate the role of the United States, of any regional, particular regional actor, or any external actor in what happened. This was a bottom-up process that was a long time coming, and by the way, it's not done. those trends still exist all across the region, and they will continue to drive politics all across the region. And what that means to me is that although a lot of opportunities have been missed in the ways that Bob was describing, there are still opportunities for the U.S., for Turkey, for others who care about the fate of this region and care about stability in this region to act in ways that can support, I think, positive outcomes and shifting where possible toward a positive trajectory. So I would just argue that we acknowledge missed opportunities and errors, but that we focus in a forward-looking manner and commit to not missing anymore.
Mm-hmm. I pick up from this because one of the things we don't talk, or I think I don't see in the American debate, is how weak all states were already before the revolutions. Right. Because of the longevity of all the dictators, regimes and states have been collapsed onto one another, and they lost legitimacy. And this issue of legitimacy will haunt all the other remaining ones. And what makes this difficult, to the extent that Syria, which starts as a domestic matter, turns into a regional confrontation and kind of a global one, the Saudis or whomever have the money for the moment interact with these crises with no regard whatsoever that institution building and state rebuilding are essential if we're going to get out of that without massive chaos. And I'm not sure that the United States can actually convince all the actors. I really don't think it can determine how things will go, but there must be other ways of looking at the issue and design policy accordingly. I may have misheard you, but you may not have had enough time to put it more in a more complicated way, but I'm afraid that those who blame the administration for its failures, and there are plenty, do not take into account that those underlying factors which nobody can really correct. So to look at the Middle East with the old paradigm will lead us to misguided policies, I'm afraid.
That's all. I'd like to conclude by making one remark of mine, which kind of builds on Bob's, Tamara's, and Soli. When I look at the Middle East and compare the Europe of the 1990s, Central and Eastern Europe, it's not just states were weak and institutions were collapsing. I think in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe, the economies had collapsed too. There were no economies left. So to come back to Tamara's point about still opportunities being out there, I think as we look at those opportunities and beyond them, one should start to think about how to jumpstart the economies of the Middle East. And bearing in mind that demographically, the Middle East is still challenging and still young, it has pluses and minuses. With that, I'd like to bring this conference to an end. Thank Bob, Tamara, and Soli, but as well as the whole audience here for your engagement. Thank you very much.